Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitars that I've been playing lately. The S1 has two separate channels. It has one for your guitar and then another one for a microphone. And then there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you could access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch plug. And the S1s are also very easy to carry. It's got an easy to grab top handle and absolutely anyone can tote it around. And it's also rechargeable for up to 11 hours. The S1 was specifically designed to optimize the sound of your acoustic guitar on acoustic guitar gigs. The guitar and mic channels each have separate tone, volume, and reverb controls, and there's also a proprietary tone match switch, which restores and optimizes the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically the biggest problem with acoustic amps. Now, I tested the S1 myself, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls sound great, and they're very responsive. You can position the S1 in four different ways. You can tilt it back so you broadcast out to an audience, or you could put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. And the cool thing is the S1 has a Bose accelerometer, so it automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound for whichever one of these four positions you're using. The S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker that Bose makes, which is pretty compelling since Bose is known for the quality of their Bluetooth speakers. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. And the bottom line is this. If you're an acoustic guitar player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big that's also easy to carry and battery powered. As far as the Bluetooth speaker goes, I've used it many times here at home for family barbecues, and the sound is so good, my kids wind up arguing over who gets to play the music they want. You know, it's literally like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can use the S1 for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend a bunch of money on loads of different speakers and pedals to get the same thing the S1 does on its own. On top of that, it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money-back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years for any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. That's everyoneloversguitar.com/S1. Get the S1. It's outstanding. Did you know if your guitar, bass, pedals, or any of your music gear is damaged, broken, or stolen outside your home, your homeowner's insurance policy will not provide coverage for any of it? That's right. Homeowner's insurance only pays if something happens inside your home and if the items are not used for business purposes. But Music Pro Insurance insures all your music gear no matter where it is, anywhere in the world, even when you check it in as baggage on an airline. Here, let me give you some actual examples of coverage they've provided. You're in a car accident and your equipment is damaged, boom, you're covered. Your kid pours apple juice into your amplifier, covered. Someone accidentally spills beer all over your pedal board at a gig, covered. In fact, any kind of theft or accidental damage is covered, even water damage from hurricane and breakage from earthquakes. But here's what makes Music Pro really different. They're not going to argue with you over the value of your instrument or make you run around looking for receipts when it comes to paying your claim. They know exactly why your vintage instrument is worth 10 times more than a new one. Plus, all claims are typically paid and fully settled in 24 to 48 hours. So if your equipment is not insured properly, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/musicpro. Hit standard and then enter your information and get a free gear protection estimate. Don't be that musician who ignores this and then next month when something happens, you're wondering why you didn't take 10 minutes to do this properly. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/musicpro, enter your information and get a free gear protection estimate. This way, when something happens, you won't lose a minute of sleep because you took care of this already. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We've got a proper rock star with us today. We're with the one and everything about this guy's rock and roll. His hair, his looks, his music, how he plays guitar for sure. His guitars, he's got like two beat up old Les Pauls. I mean, I'm sure he's got a shit ton of guitars, which we'll talk about, but everything about Mitch Perry is rock and roll. So a couple of quick announcements, then we'll get into it. I want to thank our mutual friend, Ed Roth, keyboard player of the Stars, for hooking us up. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe, and you can subscribe to the audio and the video of the show. All right, let's talk about Mitch Perry. Born in London originally, started singing with the school choir. He wanted to be initially a race car driver like his dad. He relocated to Davie, Florida, which is just outside of Fort Lauderdale. And at that point, he became obsessed with guitar and music. At 16, after a near-perfect score in the SATs. Dude, what did you score in the SATs?
I have no idea. I don't know where that came from.
This is folklore.
Well, no, they did tell me I had high scores and that I didn't need to stick around in high school. So they gave me my GED and I was out of there.
There you go. Yeah, it says here that you convinced your parents to let you take the GED and leave school behind. I would have loved to be a fly on the wall in that conversation. I'm sure it wasn't as easy as convincing. Shortly after that, Mitch began playing with local bands all over South Florida. At 18, on Pat Thrall's recommendation, Pat, of course, was Pat Travers' guitar player, Santana's bassist Alfonso Johnson flew Mitch to L.A. to record a record. In the following years, Mitch wound up playing with everyone from Michael Schenker, Edgar Winter, Cher, Lita Ford, David Lee Roth, and then he recorded with Glenn Hughes, Talas, Faster, that's a New York band, right? Upstate Buffalo, yeah. I think. Yeah,
absolutely.
Faster Pussycat, Keel, Frankie Miller, Heaven, and Graham Nash. Wow, that's like one of those things is not like the others, to name but a few. And you might know Mitch best from Heaven's recording of MTV favorite song Knocking on Heaven's Door. He's featured on more than 60 albums, including Aerosmith's Classics Live, where he actually plays keyboards. Mitch has a new album coming out in the springtime here called Music Box by the Mitch Perry Group. The album features drummer Tal Bergman, bass player Dan McNay, who also played in Montrose and is currently touring with Great White, and the aforementioned keyboardist Ed Roth, whose resume includes Annie Lennox, the Brothers Johnson, Glenn Hughes, Montrose, and Robbie Krieger. Mitch was presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Producer's Choice Awards in March 2017, and he's currently performing regularly with Sweet and playing with local musicians and jam bands in LA. He's got a standing gig for those of you in California. He's got a standing gig every Sunday at the Standing Room in Hermosa Beach. Where is that? Is that like LA or
just south of the airport? Right, it's called the South Bay. In LA, and it's right there by Hermosa Pier.
Very cool. So there you go, all you LA cats, come check out Mitch. Dude, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Looking forward to this.
I watched a bunch of videos. I love watching you play guitar because you make it look so, I know it's not obviously, but you make it look what you do is so easy, and you're like really having a good time up there. That comes across loud and clear.
I mean, that's, especially these days, that's the only reason to play.
Yeah.
That's how you should feel, because hopefully you're making other people feel that way. And you can't do that unless you're there.
Yeah. Well, it really shows, man, to be honest with you. All right. So your parents are American, but you were born in London.
No, I don't know where that. That's a little bit of misinfo. I was born in New York.
Okay.
And the first 10 years of my life, I lived in New York. My dad raced cars, and we moved to London in 1971.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's about the, you know, all I wanted to do at that point was race cars. And I ended up picking up a guitar when we were in London and jamming along with 10cc on Top of the Pops.
I'm Not in Love.
Well, this was way before that, with Rubber Bullets. But I mean, it's funny, like, you know, there I was 10 years old. I remember, you know, here I am touring with Steve Priest and Sweet now. You know, I remember moving to London in 1971, seeing Sweet on TV on Top of the Pops and calling my parents into the room to see the Freaks.
That's so funny, man.
Yeah.
Where in New York did you grow up?
Hewlett.
Where is that? Is it upstate?
In Five Towns.
Oh, Long Island. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I could ride my bike to JFK.
Yeah, I know exactly where that is, man. Okay, so then you moved back to Florida, or you moved to Florida?
We moved when my dad decided to retire from racing. We moved to Florida in late 73, and that's when I started getting serious, about playing guitar. It's consumed me, and that's all I did for the next 5 years.
And how did you convince? Well, two questions. How did you convince your parents to let you get out of school? And the second question is...
Well, here's the thing. I was in London for 3 years, and I went to Westminster City, which was one of the best prep schools you could go to. The classes I was taking, there were French, Latin, algebra, chemistry, religious education.
Wow.
I came back. Now, when I came back to Florida, which I think was ranked 52nd out of the 50
states. It's horrible. Yeah.
You know, I mean, they skipped me a year right away, and then I got skipped a second year. So I was in advanced classes, and I was already, like, you know, way young. And it got to a point where my interest in school became zero.
Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, and we went through, you know, I managed to be able to ace the tests, but I never was sticking around for any of the classwork.
Sure.
You know, and here's a funny music-related story about school there. You know, this is Davie, Florida, South Florida. Well, I had a photography teacher who really took an interest in my guitar playing. He was a trumpet player who played in a band called the Ocean Liners. The Ocean Liners went on to become Casey and the Sunshine Band.
Holy shit.
Okay, so he liked the way I played guitar. He would write me passes. I could skip any class. And he let me hang out in the dark room and practice guitar.
Oh, my God. How cool is that?
Yeah. So, you know, so these things were going on, and my parents were having meetings with the guidance counselor. And I was lucky that I had a real cool guidance counselor who said to them, look, his SAT scores are so high, he'll be able to get into any college that he wants when he decides it's time. So let him just get a GED now, and, you know.
And that was fine. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, you know, and my parents were really cool parents.
I mean, to
this day. I mean, you know, all through the 80s, I mean, they're calling me up for passes to Black Sabbath. You
know, so, that's wild. You know. Hey, how far out did Davie, how far west did Davie go at that time? Because it's...
We were as far west. I mean, there was nothing except swampland on the other side of 27. You know, you had Sunshine Ranches, which was a little bit further out. and there wasn't much past that.
You know? Wow.
Not that civilized people have done any.
Yeah. Holy shit, that's wild, man. So that was pretty. That was pretty cool. Like, so the whole situation was like the universe was kind of supporting you with all these different people, like encouraging you to do music.
Oh yeah, you know, man, my life. You know, sometimes when I tell people all the stories and people who I've been around and involved with, I mean, I feel like I'm a real life Forrest Gump. You know, there's so and so, you know, and there's Mitch's face in the background. But I've been really, really fortunate to always be in an area where you know, cool things are going on. I mean, you know, the situation that I lucked into in Florida, I mean, I had no game plan to play music. I mean, yes, I decided I liked playing guitar and I had a knack for it and I didn't put it down, but that was as far as my thought process went. I didn't consider, you know,
career
opportunities, yeah. You know, and then, you know, by the time I was getting to the GED phase, I was realizing I could live in a band house and have a great time. And back then you could make a living and you know, support yourself playing top 40. Now,
especially in the Miami, South Florida area, there's
Well, if you know that whole thing, there was a lady named Sheila Witkin. She ran an agency called, appropriately enough, the agency, but they literally, they had a monopoly on everything rock and roll down there. And she managed the biggest band of the area at the time, Tight Squeeze. You know, and their guitar player, Kaz Candler, went on to join the Romantics.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So anyway, they had this house. And her son had a friend, Bino, who played drums. And her son was 14, Bino was 16, and I was 15. And anyway, I had played in a battle of the bands somewhere, you know, in Coconut Grove, and Tight Squeeze was in it. We didn't, you know, even make the finals, but I think the people in Tight Squeeze noticed me and my age and went, there's the guitar player for Bruce and Bino's. Well, I'm hitchhiking to the beach one day.
So typical Florida.
These two kids pick me up in a Volkswagen. We start talking. It turns out they're Bruce and Bino. They figure out I'm the guitar player that
they'd
heard about. Instead of going to the beach, we go to their house, and I end up moving in, and we put a band together called The Kids. We started playing locally, and Tight Squeeze opened up their own club. We were the house band along with Tight Squeeze there. And I mean, in the summer of 79, the amount of people who came through there, I mean, we had Black Sabbath recording Highway to Hell at Criteria. They were in the club all the time. AC/DC doing Highway to Hell at Criteria. They were in the club all the time. You know, we had Ted Nugent come through there. We had Steven Tyler come through there. We had Pat Travers in the club all the time because he was doing all his recording at Quad Radial. I mean, it was an insane, you know, Mike Panera as well lived down there. And George Terry, who played in Eric Clapton's band and all those Killer Bee Gee recordings. You know, all these guys were in at this club. And it was just, it was the luckiest scene to have, you know, to be able to grow up and learn how to play in an environment like that where it's just music 24/7. It was absolutely, absolutely lucky.
That's amazing, man. Yeah. What from a maturity standpoint, you were so young, man. Wasn't that overwhelming? Like just everything?
You know, I mean, it's funny. At the time, no. You know, at the time, you're young and you probably don't know better.
Right.
I mean, it's funny. I when Alfonso flew me out to LA to record with him. You got to realize he was a bass player in Weather Report.
Yeah.
Jaco replaced Alfonso, you know, and so I haven't even recorded myself on a cassette recorder. And here I am in the recording studio with him. You know, it was really trial by fire, you know, baptism by fire.
Yeah.
I was learning, but I at the time I was either too excited or not smart enough to be really overwhelmed by it. In hindsight, I wish I'd known more at the time, because I would have taken so much more advantage.
Yeah.
So many of the situations I was in. I mean, you know, with hindsight being 2020, I can see so many things that I would have done that I didn't even have a clue to do back then.
Yeah, of course. Well, you're so young. I mean, you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, really young, incredibly young.
Yeah.
I'm going to name some artists that you've worked with, Mitch. If you could talk about how you first connected with them or how you got the gig, and any kind of interesting or cool story about working with them. Let's start with Michael Schenker.
Absolutely great story. Okay, first off, important to know, once I decided I wanted to be a rock guitar player, my two heroes basically became Jimmy Page and Michael Schenker.
Yeah.
I love Michael's tone and his feel and his style. I mean,
he was so unique. No, I mean, he was so unique, man. I mean, he really was. Really was.
Well, you know, let's fast forward a whole bunch of years, and I'm signed to Lieber and Krebs management with the band Heaven. Michael was signed to Lieber and Krebs as well at the time. And so Michael, this is funny, this is when Michael was not behaving well.
That was a long period of time from what I understand.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know who the genius was who came up with the idea of putting him at the record plant in Times Square. It was Heaven. But it was our job to watch him one day, and it was cool because I got to hang out with him, and it was neat to meet one of my idols.
Yeah.
Anyway, fast forward about 3 years later, and I've left Heaven. I'm out in L.A., and I'm hanging out with Pete Way at the Oakwood Apartments.
From UFO.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's got a band called Wasted, and I'm talking about joining them, you know. And so I'm literally in the swimming pool, and Michael shows up, and he hears I'm in the swimming pool. He comes up and says, "Oh, Mitchie, you know, what are you doing?"
You do the accent pretty well.
So, but, you know, he knew that I played keyboards because, you know, he was there when we were recording Knocking on Heaven's Door. And I played the keyboards on that.
Where did you learn how to play keyboards?
I had a piano around the house, so I just banged on stuff myself.
One question, just to take you off along the same lines, you were 100% self-taught on guitar.
Yeah.
Where did you learn your theory?
Books and just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just teaching myself stuff out of books after. You know, it was like all this stuff looked like hieroglyphics, and then I'd put it together and go, "Oh, that's all it is."
So you're like one of these rare people. You have left and right brain kicking, because usually you don't have both.
You say sometimes I don't have both either.
And I hear you. Don't we all? But you know what I'm saying? It's tough. You know, the same discipline. And, you know, look, if you did really well on the SATs, you're certainly not a dummy. You're very bright. So you just took that you just took that skill set and that discipline and you applied it to music, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Very cool.
But we got to jump back to this.
Yeah, sorry about
Michael
that.
Michael thing. The Michael thing. So, long story short, he says, "We're looking for a guitar player, keyboard player. Would you want to do it?" And I'm like, "No, I don't want to play rhythm guitar all night." And he had seen me do all the
good for you to say that, man. Good for you to say that. A lot of people would have been like, oh my God, yeah. But that's
well, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean.
No, seriously, that took that. Yeah. I think that took some courage and confidence in your ability, and that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I also, you know, it wasn't, it was weird. I mean, I didn't really think too much of it at the time. I mean, you right. know, it, so I suppose I was a little bit more cavalier with it, but he was serious, so serious, in fact. He, you know, when I said that, he goes, no, the way you do all this tapping and stuff that I don't do, he says, but I think people want to hear that. He says, so if you come in and do some of that and don't sound like me, I think this is could work.
Oh, so he was willing to give you lead duties.
So at that point, my eyebrow gets raised. He goes, I have a solo that you will sound great on. He goes, you want to come play on it? I go, yeah, when? He yeah. goes, what are you doing now? I go, swimming. He goes, well, you have a guitar? Hey, there's one upstairs. He goes, well, go get it and come to the studio with me. We literally, I go upstairs, dry off, grab the guitar, and get in the car with Michael. We go over to Sound City, where Rob McCauley and Andy Johns and Olaf Schroeder, the manager, the German manager from for the Scorpions and MSG, they're all at the studio waiting for Michael.
Oh, and, my God.
Not one of them knows of me or who I am.
Oh, yeah. So this has got to be weird.
So Michael waltzes in and says, hey, everybody, this is Mitch. He's going to try the solo on Give Me Your Love.
Holy crap.
Can you imagine? And so, yeah, they take him out of the room, and I'm sitting there by myself for about half an hour going, oh, well, it was nice while it lasted.
Yeah, yeah.
But, no, you know, they came out. We hit record. It went well, and that's the soul you hear on Give Me Your Love.
That is so cool. Did they not act like dicks once they came back in as much as possible?
Yeah. Yeah, they were cool with you? Olaf was always a dick.
Yeah. But like
no, Michael and Robin and Andy, yeah, that was really a treat. I was really lucky to get to work with people like that.
That's really cool. Was it that one project and that was it, or was there anything? Was there more? Did you tour behind that or anything?
Oh
or?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, dude, this was the best time in the world to be a part of that band. For the whole year of 1988, we were touring, and we were out with one of three bands. We were either out on the road with Def Leppard,
oh my
God, either out on the road with Whitesnake, or we're either out on the road with Rush. So,
wow, that doesn't suck.
Yeah, it was touring like the biggest shows at the time with the biggest bands, you know. And funnily enough, even as big as Def Leppard was, when we went to Europe with MSG and Def Leppard, Michael pulled a lot of people there, as Def Leppard did. So,
I had Phil on the show, Phil Collins from Def Leppard. Was he sober then, or
no?
Oh, okay. So it was different. It was a different Phil Collins.
None of us were. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so funny because I toured with them. Like I said, that was 87 and 88. And then in 2012, I went back out on the road with them because I was with Lita Ford.
Right.
And we did Def Leppard, Poison, and Lita. And what a difference 25 years makes.
Oh, yeah, man. They're having trainers. He's going to the gym in the day. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Drinking water and, like, you know, waking up at 5 a.m. doing kickboxing.
Backstage is not the same place.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. Wow, that's great. Def Leppard, Whitesnake, and Rush. Holy crap. That is so cool. What did you get out of that tour? Like, is there any lessons, I don't necessarily musically, but like either business or performing or anything like that. Did you get anything out of that?
Yeah, out of the Leppard tour for sure. It's where I learned to stop ever counting on a monitor.
Go ahead, elaborate.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we're always waiting for our sound checks, you know, and you when you did get them, you never seemed to get enough of one. And all it would allow you to do, you know, you'd do enough to decide what you didn't like, and you could fixate on that until you played. I almost got into a thing where I preferred to not go out and all the instruments on stage are loud, you know, you should be able to hear everything.
Yeah.
And I like the feel of the stage better. I kind of got used to telling my monitor guy to turn everything off.
Yeah.
At a real early age, I didn't like having, you know, a lot of people try and turn their monitor into a stereo speaker. And
yeah, I could see that.
It's not a stereo system. You know, what that's there for is, for me, is if I can't hear the kick, if I can't hear the hi-hat, put it in there. If I need a little bit more lead vocal, put it in there. If I, you know, if I'm singing, obviously put vocal in there.
Right.
But, you know, put what I can't hear in there. All the stuff that's loud, we don't need to put in there.
Right. Interesting.
You know? And I mean, not that I came to that conclusion at that point, but I remember I gave up on ever expecting to hear anything I wanted out of the monitors.
So you just learned to make do with what you could hear out of the speakers.
Yeah.
Was that hard to do, like, initially? Like, did you ever get preoccupied from playing with listening to what was going on?
No. I mean, I think you have, if you really, the magic of music is when people are connected and doing that. And I think you have to be doing that. I mean, constantly and totally. That yeah. way you react to what's going on around you. And that's when you get that, that's when you get those magic bands. You go, hey, man, why does this one band sound so much better than the next band? They're all great players.
Yeah.
It's not the chops. You could learn for the next 20 years. It's not going to change the dynamics that are making one better than the other. What's the magic is how those people are reacting to each other.
Yeah, very much.
And the only way for that to happen is when you're tuned in.
Yeah.
You know, so you better be able to do, you know, I think that's part of, I draw a lot of analogies with racing, you know, because I like racing.
Yeah,
and
sure.
The thing is, you know, you go, you look at a race, and you see the 33 cars in Indianapolis, and you think the guy tooling around, you know, at the back is not a fast driver. That's not true. All of those guys can drive like a badass. But the ones who run up front are the ones who can drive like a badass, but have a whole lot of power, you know, brain power left to be thinking about all the peripherals that are going to affect their race and where they've got to position their car. So now it's not a matter of, you know, the faster guy being the faster guy. We know they're both fast. It's the smarter guy's going to put his car in a better place. The guys who have a lot more room, you know, or, you know, for that thought, are the ones who always consistently win, you know? And I think it's the same thing in music when you're playing. If you're having to think about what you're doing or concentrate on your stuff too hard, you can do it right. If you're having to sight read, you can do it right. But, man, you lose the magic that's going to make your performance magic.
That's interesting. You know? Do you think that, like, so in your opinion, most of the people that you've come across over your career musically that were successful, if I'm understanding what you're saying, right, and I agree with you, actually, not just in music, I think in everything, do you think most of the people that you've met that were successful also tended to be a little smarter?
Listen, if I, I got to be careful about how I answer that.
Right. And I'm not like trying to like say, no, but I mean, I think
there's no rhyme or reason.
Yeah. Right.
To what's, you know, there's things that people,
sometimes really stupid people get really lucky because they're in the right place at the right. Yeah.
And sometimes is an underestimate.
No, I hear you. I totally get it. But I think it's like that with everything for the most part. Even in business, it's the same thing. The guys who have a little more wherewithal to look at the periphery and see the whole picture tend to get ahead. But it's the same thing. Then you got some guys like they, you know, they can't even chew gum and walk at the same time.
I can give you a perfect example. You know, this is a funny story. But, you know, Nikki Sixx came up to me at like either the end of 1980 or beginning of 1981. You know, and back in that time, you know, I was wearing the colored Sassans and the Capizios. My hair's halfway down my waist, and I got the colored shirts tied at the waist, Robert Plant style, you know. you know, so Nikki comes up to me and says, "Man, I just quit London. And because I've got this new band, it's going to rule the world." Oh, no, he's going to ask me to play guitar. And he's like, "Do you know a singer?" He goes, "We're looking for a singer." I go, "Oh, I don't know anyone." He goes, "No." He goes, "Do you want to try singing?" I'm going, "No, I don't sing." "Well, do you want to just come down and try?" "Yeah, I'm a guitar player." He goes, "Yeah, you're a great guitar player, but..." You know, he goes, "We got a guitar player." He says, "We need a singer." He goes, "You got a great image. You got great hair. Just come down, take a singing lesson, try a rehearsal." "Nah, dude, I play guitar."
Yeah.
And I laughed for a long time about the fact that the music didn't even enter into it.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't. I used to laugh at that.
Yeah.
However, now with hindsight being 2020, I go, who knew what they were doing back then? And sure as fuck wasn't me.
Yeah, right.
He had a clear vision. Even though I used to laugh at that at the time, you know, he knew exactly what he was doing. So,
interesting.
To answer your question, yeah, he saw it.
Yeah.
On a different scale. But one that for me probably didn't even really include the music. You know, it was more the attitude of the music than the actual.
Yeah, yeah. Like he wasn't your hair, your look. Yeah. That's interesting. But he had a vision of putting all this together that obviously worked really well.
Yeah. You know, wow. And like I said, at the time, I didn't even have a clue. I just saw, you know. So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of other things going on besides being that magical player, you know, or musician that can contribute to who was successful and who wasn't.
Definitely, you know? Man. Let's talk about somebody else. Edgar Winter. How'd you get connected with Edgar?
Well, first off, I was a huge, huge, huge Edgar Winter fan. Yeah. And in 1994, Carmine Appice and Tony Franklin called me up to do a tour of Japan. It was going to be a Blue Murder tour.
Right.
And then they had their falling out with John. There was a singer.
Wanted you to basically take John Sykes' place.
Basically, yeah. And they had a singer, Kelly Keeling, who was going to sing instead of John. So we went to Japan and basically did this tour. It was a great tour to do because, I mean, it's like we called it Super Rock Session. We did a ton of Beck.
Super Kroger. Rock Session. That's cool. It's like, yeah. Is that from Super Sessions, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
that's cool.
Was, you know, Carmine, he always had a cool angle for this stuff. and so we did like, you know, did some of the stuff. If I had a solo album out at the time in Japan and instrumental, we did stuff from there. We did BBA stuff. We did murder stuff. We did a couple of songs from the firm, you know, and it was just,
that's a great, Great. The whole thing sounded great.
Oh, it was a blast. I mean, I've got cassette tapes of our, we only did like three rehearsals and then went over and did this. And I've got rehearsal tapes that are just, put them on. I'm like, this band is pretty damn good.
Yeah, but so, the three of you talk about talent, man. That's like a lot of talent there, man. Yeah. You, Carmine, and Tony Franklin.
And it was funny, while we were there, Carmine's talking about going out on the road with Edgar when he gets home. And I'm like, man, Edgar's one of my heroes. If you ever need a guitar player, tell him to call me. And literally half a week into the tour, they called me because the guitar player had some personal stuff go on. And I literally got a tape of the show. They taped Wednesday night's show or Tuesday night's show, FedExed it out to me Wednesday. I got it Thursday and listened to it on the plane to play the show Thursday night.
Holy crap.
And I didn't leave for the next 10 years.
Wow. Yeah. Oh my God. That is, what a great story that is.
Yeah, no, I love playing with Edgar, and musically is the best finishing school.
He's so bright as a musician, man. Arranger, everything.
Nothing he doesn't understand or get. Every time, the entire time I was there, I don't think we rehearsed, but three or four times, but we managed to do, three records and, just all sorts of shows and,
That's wild, man.
We never ever had things worked out. It was always spontaneous, and that was a great thing. There were no, parameters. The only rules were be good, but we basically played the stuff the way we wanted to play it. And I just wanted it to be good.
You probably got to play with loads of other people there, because I know he's always had like.
Absolutely. Yeah. I got to work with Leon Russell, with Dr. John, Eddie Money, Rick Derringer, a whole lot. We did a few White Trash reunions. I was there even the one time he got back together with Jerry LaCroix. Like I said, I couldn't have asked for a better person to learn how to play music from.
That's great. I've had a lot of Leon's guitar players over the years on the show, and they all said he is just the nicest human being ever.
Yeah. He's good. It's so funny is when we first went out with Leon when I was in the band, his son Teddy was playing drums with him, and Teddy comes up to me and he's all like, "Man, you're from MSG. You played MSG." He's like tripping that I played with Shanker. I'm like, "Dude, your dad's Leon Russell. What the fuck are you?"
Yeah, right on. Who was playing guitar for Leon when you were touring with him? Do you remember?
I don't.
Was it Bob Britt? If you remember,
I could not tell you.
Very cool story. David Lee Roth. I didn't realize you played with David Lee Roth.
Yeah, well, never publicly. I don't know how that got into the thing, but yeah, I actually got hired to replace Steve Vai when Steve left.
Oh.
But I was only there for a very short while. I don't have a really good poker face.
Yeah, I hear you.
and so, we're working on some material that wasn't written by Dave. It was written by some outside writers. And let's just put it this way. If you thought Paradise, was kind of departing from the Van Halen, the hard rock.
Yeah.
I mean, that was heavy, heavy guitar rock compared to the stuff we were working on.
Oh, so it was more like just a gigolo kind of thing.
Yeah, except not even as cool. These songs were garbage.
Yeah, that's too bad.
And so, like I said, I'm not stupid. I'm not going to say anything, but my face.
Yeah, he knew you were not happy, camper.
Yeah, and so he starts, you know, he's asking me what I think, and, you know, as a, and, you know, he's a good interrogator. He finally got what I thought out of me, and that was that.
Yeah, that's weird. What do you think? You don't like it? Okay, you don't fit. Okay, that's weird. Yeah. Not the first person that makes decisions like that. But,
well, no, I mean, you know, I think I got comfortable and was a little over exuberant. Now I told him that the songs weren't that great.
Yeah.
But you know, long story short, they replaced me with another guitar player, who was with them for 7 months. They got Bob Ezrin in, and Ezrin said, "Okay, I'll produce a record, but the guitar player has to go, and you have to come up with different material."
Oh, funny enough.
Yeah, and so, you know, I did get a call back to come back, and but it was really obvious. Ezrin had brought Jason Becker in.
Right.
And it was obvious that Bob was being courteous and watching me, you know. He'd already made the decision that Jason was going to play, which I'm glad he did.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, so that
wonderful thing is hindsight.
Was that the iteration with the Bissonette with Matt and Greg?
Yeah.
Those guys, I had both those guys. Those guys are so nice, man.
They're the best. It was funny.
The nicest guys.
I had a conversation with Matt about it a long time afterwards. He's like, he goes, "Yeah, man, we couldn't believe you said that." He goes, "We were all thinking it, but we weren't going to say it."
Wow, that's funny. Yeah, Matt's such a good guy. I have remained buddies with Matt. We talk, you know, once a month or so. He's such a nice guy. Oh, both of those guys.
Please tell him I said hello.
Man, I will. I definitely will. That's so funny. This one, that one of these things is not like the others. Graham Nash, who's a great musician, but just totally out of context with these other guys.
You know, once again, we could go back to the thing where I was saying, I wish I was mentally equipped to learn more at the time than I did, because I really was very fortunate. My roommate at the time was someone I knew from Florida. He was a staff engineer at Criteria, and then Tom Dowd took him under his wing, and he ended up doing all like the Allman Brothers and Kenny Loggins and all the stuff that Tom Dowd did. He was the main engineer, Steve Gursky.
Unreal.
Anyway, he was my roommate out here while he was co-producing Crosby, Stills, Nash, their Daylight Again record. So I wound up around that camp quite a lot, just hanging out and whatnot. And when Graham was doing a song for Fast Times at Ridgemont High, they were in the studio. Steve was recording it, and they were not happy with the harmonica solo that Graham was doing. And they decided they wanted a guitar solo. They called me up, and I came down, and I got to play on Graham Nash's song at Fast Times at Ridgemont High. And, you know, it's so funny. I'll never forget sitting around with him, and Graham was as gracious as could be. I mean, just, a wealth of information, you know. It was really
so
really
talented, that guy. I mean, just incredibly talented musician, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, plus everybody who was on those sessions. I mean, you had Ian Wallace and Mike Finnegan. You know, I mean, Kenny Passarelli. I mean, serious, serious players.
That's so cool, man.
Yeah, I mean, I was so lucky to be around these guys, because once, you know, it's funny. I look at videos of myself playing when I was in Talis from 1983. The fingers move just as fast then as they do now. But I'm 3 trillion times a better musician now than I was then.
Yeah.
okay, now it's obviously nothing about the fingers. But the funny thing is, all that stuff that, you know, you think I've accumulated over the years, I don't think any of it wasn't told to me back then by those guys in that camp. You know, Steve was a really, really wise, you know, he was a great engineer producer, but he knew music, he could play as well. And I think everything that I understand or that I get that makes me a quality musician, they were telling me all this stuff back then, but hearing it and not really understanding it are two different things.
Yeah, man, isn't that, that's the fucked up thing with life sometimes. Like, you realize something 20 years after that you, but it's not, but I always look at it, you know what, I couldn't, you know, you can't do what you can't do at any given time. So I'm just grateful that I finally get the message at some point, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's always like that. It's very much like that. Is there anybody you want to talk about or any situation that was cool or interesting?
Oh,
you got no shortage of them, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there have been so many amazing things. I mean, you know, whether it's, you know, playing Wembley on New Year's Eve with, you know, the bill with Whitesnake and Brian May and Iron Maiden and all those people all at the show. Or, you know, I mean, when we did the Montreux Jazz Festival in 99 with Edgar, we opened up for B.B. King and Johnny Lang opened up for us. And Gary Moore was there to play with B.B. and Rick Derringer was playing with us. These are, you know, really, really cool things. One of my favorite records that I got to do was with a singer. I don't know. Are you familiar with Frankie Miller?
No.
Oh, you'll want to check him out. He's Paul Rodgers' favorite singer. He's one of Bob Seger's favorite singers, Rod Stewart's favorite singers. Him and Paul Rodgers basically came up together, and they would trade off guitar players. They'd trade off Paul Kossoff and Mick Rells all the time.
Oh, and who does he sound like? Or what hits?
He sounds like Paul Rodgers sounds like Frankie.
Oh, wow.
I mean, yeah, I don't mean that as a disservice. I mean, Paul Rodgers is.
Of course. There was nothing slighted. I mean,
it's not like when you hear Frankie, they came up together. You know, it's like James Brown and Little Richard. You know, right. They've been together since they were 13 and 14. It's not a mystery why they're both so great. You know, they come from the same DNA, and it's the same thing with Frankie and Paul.
He's an English guy, Frankie.
Yeah. Miller. Oh, and the band, I was really lucky to get on the record. It was timing again, because John Jansen, who produced Knocking on Heaven's Door, was producing Frankie's next record. And the band was Simon Kirk from Bad Company, Chrissy Stewart from Spooky Tooth, and Brian Robertson from Thin Lizzy.
Wow.
And Brian was having one of his bad periods, and I ended up getting called to come in and play on a song, which became 2, 3, 4, you know, 6 songs. But it's one of the coolest records.
What's the name of the record?
Dancing in the Rain.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely check it out.
Oh, yeah, it's a cool record. The song that I'm really proud of being on that record is Do It Till We Drop.
Thanks, man. I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything Frankie does is usually pretty, it's worth a listen. He's great.
I know you're really excited about your record coming out. You want to talk about that for a bit?
Oh man. Yeah. I can't wait for this thing to come out. You know, it's funny. I think everyone probably expects me to do an album that's, you know, a Guitar Hero record. I love songs. And one of the things I miss is the great records that were made in the 70s, where you would put an album on and you'd listen to it like you watch a movie.
Oh, yeah, man.
That just has not happened in a long time. And, you know, so I obviously I have a lot of material to choose from. You know, a lot of this record, although most of it is new material, there's a couple of things that I pulled out of the archives. It's just, and I've got a record that I just feel is really, 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 a throwback to, those days when, you know, I go, you listen to classic rock now and the drag for me is none of it's new. It's yeah. great. It's all wonderful, but none of it's new. And I feel like this record is that, but it's got songs of that quality. You know, I was talking about this with David Krebs. I said, the problem is if you want to do a new classic rock thing, you're not competing against all the bands at the same time. You're competing against Stairway to Heaven. You're competing against
Bad Company.
You're competing against the best of the best from the best. So there's really no point in 90% of the bands that would do it doing it. But I think we've got a record with songs that, you know, hold up to that kind of listening. The production has turned out. I'm really proud of it. And,
where did you record? Did you record it like at a home studio? Or did you go to a
No. We did it. Tal Bergman, our drummer, Tal from Billy Idol and Joe Bonamassa. He has a studio, which used to be Quincy Jones's studio. So it's quite a nice place, and we tracked all the stuff live there. One of the things we did on this record, absolutely no click track.
Awesome.
And whatever song you're hearing, the live band is playing. I mean, there was no, let's just get drums and then add bass. It's like, even if we added production, it was to the live performance.
Awesome.
And so it's got that old feel, you know. It's like you can see people listen to it, and I think, you know, you can tell they know something's there.
That's awesome, man.
You don't get music that much, or at least I don't that much. You know, Pro Tools is like a drug. It's a wonderful thing. It's like a wonderful thing if you use it to cure, you know, your cold. But unfortunately, like most drugs, it gets abused.
Yeah. The solution to your problem becomes your problem.
Yes. I'm really proud of this record. You know,
that's awesome.
I went out of my way to not fix things that, you know, my mind's going, I want it to be real. And I think we got that.
Did Tal engineer it?
No, we have, you know, a couple of different guys were involved, but the main guy who's also mixing the record with me, Yossi Shackett, great engineer. We like I said, did all the tracks and few dubs at Tal's. And then we moved over to his place, which I call the Love Shack. But we did a bunch of overdubs there and mixed there. And we also used a friend of mine, Shane Chalosky. We used his studio to do a lot of tracking of the guitars.
Very cool, man. Well, I look forward to hearing it. And it's called Music Box. And Mitch is going to come back on the show once the record drops. So we'll all get to talk about it. What were some of the low points for you or darker periods you've had to deal with, and how did you get through them?
Oh, well, you know, here's the thing. As far as it being a low point, you know, I would say after I quit Edgar's band, there was no one I really wanted to play for. There's no one I really want, you know, there's no one I wanted to start a band with. And I didn't like the direction music was going, you know, there's nothing that held my interest. So fortunately, I still love race cars. And along the way, I'd ended up going, here's a funny story. When I played with Cher, I bought myself a Celine Mustang, and I lost my license within 2 weeks of having the car.
Oh my God.
And so, my dad, who had always, he didn't want to ever hear about me getting into a race car. He finally suggests I should go to racing school and find out I'm not the hot shit I think I am before I kill myself on the road. And so I do. And I went up to the Jim Russell School at Laguna Seca. They have a year-end runoffs every year and pick their three best, you know, students and run a racing, you know, put them on a race team and pay for them to race. And that's what happened to me.
So you got picked.
I was 31 and I got picked to be in, you know, I got a scholarship from the Jim Russell School and ended up spending a lot of that year racing a car the next year. Always kept my hand in that. And when I left Edgar's band, I just basically started teaching race car driving.
Wow.
Yeah, and just I taught at Skip Barber for a while, and I taught at Dale Jarrett School, and then a company that my friend Kelly Bussey ran, the Racing Experience. And, you know, I did that pretty much up until about 2008, 2009. And then I got so busy playing music again, I started doing that about 3 or 4 years after I started teaching the race cars. I mean, I'd always kept playing. I just wasn't doing it professionally.
Sure.
So.
Wow. So how long, when did you leave Edgar's?
That would have been April of 2001.
Okay. So you took like 8 years and put it into racing.
Well, no, basically, okay, in 2002, I did some dates with X, Y, and Z and Bullet Boys. In 2003, I went to Tahiti for this one gig. That's the only time I did anything. And then 2004 and 2005, I really didn't do a whole lot of anything, but I started doing sessions in 2005. That led to me joining Asia again in 2000. It was John Payne's Asia. I did that in 2008, and I did that until 2010. Then I took on Lita. I did Lita from 2010 to 2015. Okay. And Sweet since then.
So you really, so it was really kind of a part-time thing. You kind of did have your hand in music on and off.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I'll be a musician until the day I die. Even if I'm not touring, I'll be playing somewhere.
Yeah.
Cause like I said, my favorite 4 hours of any week are what we do on Sundays at the Standing Room.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you an idea how we start the day off is always an impromptu jam, right? Let's write a song on the spot.
Okay.
And that way it makes everybody's ears tune in and we're playing together. And by the time we go to songs that we know, it's like the band is dialed in, you know, and we don't ever play anything the same way twice. I mean, we'll make up stuff as we go. It depends.
Very cool. It's good. I like that idea. You do an impromptu jam to get dialed in together. That's really smart.
Oh, it makes everybody listen.
Yeah.
You know, because they can't rely on know where it's going and have their minds somewhere else. They have to stay tuned because they don't know what's coming.
Yeah, that's really smart. Where did you come up with that? That's a great idea, actually.
By accident. Did it because I was feeling something one time. And then I, you know, everyone started doing that and I realized what happened. I'm like, okay, we're gonna
find
this little exercise. And it is, it's really cool. Cause you know, sometimes we'll be doing a song and I'll just get bored in the middle of a song and I'll just, you know, I have my little, let's bring it down sign and we'll just stop in the key of whatever song we're playing in. We'll come up with a different part on the spot, you know, and everyone's dialed into listening to that. So, and everyone knows to go, there's the freedom to go and grab that stuff. You know, no one's worried about, oh, we got to play this four times and then go, you know?
Yeah. It's not like blues jam and a, or, you know, it's your, yeah, you gotta, yeah, it's interesting. That's really smart, man. I think that's really clever. To keep people,
but I mean, it's all of us are, you know, Ed's in the band and Dickie and Dan are out with Great White and I do my stuff. All of us are flying somewhere Saturday night and we all still take the first flight home on Sunday so we can
get to the gig. That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Let's talk gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars round out your top three?
Okay. This is the weirdest thing. I use a 1977 or 78. I bought it in March of 78, so I'm assuming it's a 77 Les Paul Pro. I bought it new off the shelf in 77. Once I got out to California, I stopped using it so much because Grover Jackson saw me play and gave me Charvels, and that was my first endorsement. Then when I was in MSG, well, actually when I was in Heaven, I moved to Guild guitars because I wanted something that no one else
was using. That's interesting. Yeah, that's not a normal, you don't see too many like hard rockers playing Guild.
No, I saw that whacked out looking guitar, the Blade Runner that they had. And I just, you know, everybody had a hot rodded Strat at that point. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to use that guitar because it's so different.
I have to look at that, the Guild Blade Runner.
Oh, it, you know what? Do you remember the weird guitar Joe Perry used in Walk This Way?
Not off the top of my head. He's had so many guitars, but that's it?
Yeah, he used the same guitar. And not only did he steal my name, he stole my guitar. But,
okay, so that hold on a second. That Les Paul Pro, that's the one with the is that the black one with the P90s?
Yeah.
Okay. So that guitar is so beat up. It looks awesome. The whole...
It's all mine.
Now, that's a like right under the where the pick guard would be. It's a massive chip of paint missing, right?
That is... I am human proof on why they put the pick guard.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole thing is wild. So what happens when you hit that now? You're just scraping the pick against wood or...
Oh yeah, it's the man. I'm digging that. That wood's a pit.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, and the guitar weighs so much. I'm wondering if I'm eventually going to dig deep enough to find Jimmy Hoffa's body.
Yeah, that's a heavy guitar. Those old Les Paul. That's wild, but man.
I got a funny story about that. This was in 99. We were touring with the original Grand Funk. I mean, all four guys.
Oh wow. Know,
even Craig on keyboards. And I couldn't wait to show this guitar to Mark Farner. And I hand it to him, and he holds it for a tenth of a second and doesn't even try and play it. He hands it back. He says, here, take it back. He says, wait right here. I'm going to show you what I play. And he comes back in, and he has a Parker. And I don't know if you...
Parker flies. Yeah, yeah.
They weigh... Yeah. You know, feel like... balsa wood.
Yes, they're like really light.
And remember, I have that poker face, and he sees the underwhelmed look in my face.
Yeah, they're not like attractive guitars at all, man. I mean, they look like sort of like something from the Jetsons or something.
Yeah, well, he sees that. He sees my underwhelmed look, and he goes, one day you'll understand.
Oh, because of the weight?
deal. Yeah.
And dude, I understand now.
Oh, I watch videos of you playing. I'm like, oh my God, that thing has got to weigh a ton.
Yeah, that guitar weighs 12 pounds.
Holy shit. Have you gotten like back pain over the years from that
thing? Oh, yeah, dude. I've got wicked sciatic.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's massive. 12 pounds.
That was a funny thing. When my friend started tour managing Mark a couple of years ago, I said, hey, do me a favor. Please tell Mark I understand.
I understand. Now. Yeah.
15 years later.
Holy. So is the Gold Top Les Paul with the P90s, is that like your number two?
Yeah.
Is that also a Les Paul Pro?
No, that's a 71 Deluxe, and I took my friend Jim Foote from Music Works had the same 77 P90s that are in my Black Paul, so I figured, why the heck not?
Yeah.
So I changed that. That's a great feeling guitar, too. But it's really funny. I still use my Black guitar almost exclusively. Just because it's become like a glove.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure.
You know, and the thing is with that guitar, a lot of Les Pauls, they sound great, but they don't have the range of tone that I'd like to get. With the P90s, I do get that. And, you know, I don't find too much stuff that I can't pull off with that guitar. So,
are you usually on the bridge pickup with that thing?
It depends what I'm doing. You know, one thing I do with that guitar is I work the tones a lot more than, you know, most people do. My sound is not as processed either. I mean, I've gone the gamut where I had 16 space racks that weren't big enough.
Wow.
You know, for all the effects I wanted to have, to back to where give me a tube screamer and a wah and I'm happy.
Right. That's what you're doing now, mostly?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, I have a board just so I can travel easier, but it's got a tuner, a tube screamer, a wah, and some delay. And that's it.
What kind of wah do you use? Just curious.
It's a Crybaby. It's a Crybaby.
Old school. You're totally old school.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Oh, man, you know, think about it. Everything that's been built since then has been built to emulate what?
Yeah, versions of that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, it's never been bettered.
Yeah.
They got it right that time. And unfortunately, this is a funny thing. I mean, even at NAMM this year, I'm like going, there's no companies. Gibson hasn't built the guitars. I mean, I got to go check out the new things now, but.
Dude, do you know how much money they are, though?
None of the guitars that I played, you know, a couple of years ago, I know everything's changed. But I went to Gibson to, you know, work with them, and I just wouldn't have played any of the guitars.
Yeah.
There's no comparison between my Pro and what they have. You know, and it's almost the same with the Marshall heads. I mean,
Is that what you play out of mostly, Marshalls?
I use Marshall JCM 800s, you know, and don't give me anything new. Don't give me the two channel Marshalls. It's got to, you know, be a single channel Marshall. And as long as it was maintained right, you got a tone there.
Yeah. What would be your number three guitar?
Number three guitar? I mean, that would be any number of spats that I have, or you know, it depends what the job is.
Yeah,
you know, I'll pull the guitar out for that. But otherwise, you know, I play the Paul, and it feels like a piece of me.
Yeah,
now, I can't say that about a Strat. I can play it, but I am just way more comfortable on the Pro, and I find it easier to go off in that zone that I like to get in when I play.
Sure. The Pro, the only thing with the thing that defines the Pro model, that is just the P90s.
I think so.
Yeah.
And it only has single binding. It's not double binding.
Okay.
On the body. It's funny though. I have a friend who bought a mint condition version of the same guitar. I mean, the numbers are almost the same.
Well, I mean, the serial, it's like, yeah. Okay.
It's a totally different guitar.
Wow, isn't that funny?
Yeah. I find that about everything. If a Les Paul is going to be a Les Paul and it's going to beat other guitars, but to find that guitar or to find that amp, when you find that special one,
I agree with you. That's why it's really hard to buy guitars online.
I don't see how people can do that.
It's really difficult. It's like a woman or whatever your flavor is. It's you got to have that
beyond Mungo's Russian wife deal.
Yeah, it's got to go beyond looks. You got to have that, that little thing, that chemistry kind of thing, man.
To me, it's like you can look at it. It can be what you envision. I mean, look, if somebody says to me, "Hey, Mitch, I got a 59
burst,
burst for you," I'm going to go, "Hell yeah!"
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. But at the same time, Jim Foote had one of his. In his store, and says, "Hey, come play this $75,000 guitar." He says, "You got to try it." I played it. I ain't trading my guitar for that guitar.
Yeah, I've heard that from, again, it goes to what feels good. Yeah, totally, man.
I suppose if I wouldn't trade it, because if I had to give up my guitar, $75,000 couldn't buy me what I have with that Les Paul.
Oh, I hear you.
Yeah. So,
what's the best guitar? I'm assuming is your Les Paul Pro. What's the best amp you've ever owned or played?
I actually have it now. It's my '86 Marshall JCM 800. When you hear my record, I use pretty much this one amp for the entire record.
That's awesome.
It's the guitar into the amp. Pedals are not really a part of the equation on the album.
That's awesome.
This is all the different sounds and tones we got out of it. I'm really proud of it.
You ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back, Mitch?
Oh, yes and no. I mean, it's funny. I wish I had my 68 gold top. That was the first guitar I ever sold. But at the same time, I wouldn't play it any more than I play it now.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, the nostalgia is nice, but the guitar, not necessarily so. Yeah,
exactly.
I get that.
Exactly. I have a lot of my old guitars, and they sit in their cases in the garage, And there's, I mean, I... It's funny, I did some gigs with Bobby Blotzer's Rat, a few years back. And so I didn't think the Les Paul was appropriate for that. And I pulled out a bunch of my old hot rod guitars from the 80s. And I went and had them all set up. And I put them right back into the cases and back in the closet and pulled out my Les Paul.
Good for you, man.
It's... It's what I am what I am.
Yeah, that's man. It's funny listening to you talk about, you can't put, what's one thing you cannot do here is put your guitars in the garage, as here in Florida, man. That's like the fastest way to destroy anything, You can't put paper in the garage at times.
My parents moved from Florida to Vegas, and they were nice enough to bring my entire record collection with them.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool.
Unfortunately, they stored it in the garage.
Oh, so everything warped.
Oh, my God. I got the biggest collection of scallop shells.
Oh, man. That's too bad. Speaking of records, what's the first record you ever bought, if you remember?
First record I purchased was Fragile by Yes. My first record that I actually... called my own record was a hand-me-down copy when my parents got a Magical Mystery Tour for a gift, and they already had it. I got my own copy. And I used to spend hours with my head buried in that 24-page booklet listening to that record when I was 7 or 8.
Your parents sound very cool.
Oh, they were the best. Yeah. I mean, they loved music. And I mean, I was around bands from the time I was 5 or 6, seeing live music and stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, they were completely supportive in every way of all the musical stuff that I did. I mean, they've come out and seen pretty much every band up to and including Sweet that I play with.
That's great, man. That's like, believe it or not, that's the number one thing that successful musicians have in common. Their parents were supportive, probably 99%+ of the situation. Even if the house had dysfunction in it, or addiction, or money problems, whatever, they were supportive of their child's career or their child's interest in music. It's really interesting.
I mean, when they first saw me getting, you know, kind of getting proficient, they used to take me down to this bar called McGowan's on Hollywood Beach. If you know Hollywood Beach, where the Florida Bible College, you know, it used to be called, right there. Yeah.
That all on that strip there.
Yeah. Well, you start walking up the Broadwalk. The first bar that had live music was McGowan's.
And so used to take you there.
North of the college there. And I used to go to the Sunday jams in 1974 when Mickey Carroll would play. I'd get up on stage and I'd play either Taxi by Harry Chapin or Miss American Pie by Don McLean.
Yeah, good songs. My parents
bring me there every week to go and jam.
That's really nice, man. That's very cool. Yeah. Tell me your top 3 Desert Island Discs. Knee Jerk Reaction, and just for now, this minute.
Oh, Knee Jerk Reaction. Oh boy.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Somebody emailed me and they said, I love when your guests freely tell you the low points in their life. And then when you get to this question, they writhe in agony trying to come up with the top 3.
Yeah. It's impossible. Let's see. What would be... Man. Pet Sounds would be one.
Interesting. Great record. Didn't expect you to say that.
I love that record. It's brilliant to me. Yeah. Humble Pie, Need Some Steve Marriott. So, any Humble Pie. But, you know, Rockin's pretty fucking... That's badass. See, this is so weird. I mean, they're not the top 3, but you ask me at a given time, I know what's going to come to mind. Another one of my favorite records of all time, Jay Giles, Full House Live.
That's cool.
What a rock band should be.
Yeah, that's a fun time record, man. That was a fun band in general.
Man, you know, it's amazing. I knew nothing. Of nothing when I first heard that, but I knew I loved it.
Yeah.
It hit me like, and what I mean, anytime I put that record on when I was a kid, I'd pick up my guitar and jump all over the living room rocking out with it. And what I didn't realize, the reason I did that is because that is such a perfect live album that is not fixed up. It's not doctored. Somebody hit a tape recorder. You go and look. You go and look at YouTube and watch them do their shows. That's how they did it. They were that good. And yeah,
I'm gonna check that. Right, it's called Good Time Band. You said
It's called Live Full House.
Sorry, I don't know where I got that from. Live Full House. I'm gonna listen to that. Because I like
it's one of the best live rock and roll records ever. And all right. Band is just on fire.
They're real. I really enjoyed them. They were very upbeat all the time. So it was hard to put on a Jay Giles record and like be down after that, you know?
The problem is you talk to anybody about them now and they don't know really who Jay Giles is, because they think of Jay Giles being Centerfold or any of
right.
the 80s crap that they did, which I get that it buys you retirement, but I mean, there wasn't a better rock and roll band in the early 70s.
I'm going to definitely listen to that record, man. All right. Best decision you ever made?
Is Ruth in the room?
There you go. If she's in there or not, we'll sway your answer.
It has to be. You know what? Probably best decision would be when I decided to become a musician instead of a race car driver.
That's cool, man. Tell me the most important things you've learned about yourself.
It's weird. I think I probably should have taken my career a lot more seriously in the beginning years than I did, because everything kind of just fell into my lap. I mean, like I said, when I made the Forrest Gump comment, it's funny because, like, I'll give you a for instance. My uncle is Michael Mann from Miami Vice, the producer. He married my mom's sister. So okay. I'm around stuff like that. My grandfather is John Wells, who his law firm was Rogers and Wells. He's ex-Secretary of State, William Rogers, and my granddad. He's like personal lawyer to the Shah of Iran, to Bill Casey from the CIA, to, you know, he's Nelson Rockefeller's bud,
wow. Mayor
Lindsay's campaign manager.
Mayor Lindsay.
So around all these people when I'm a kid. Then that band, The Kids, that I started, the guitar player that came in after, you know, right after I left Kaz, who went on to be in the Romantics, replaced me. But then Johnny Depp replaced him. You know,
that's wild.
And the reason I say all this stuff is I come out here, the band with Alfonso breaks up. You know, we were basically collateral damage in a big reorganization at Elektra Records. Our A&R guy got fired and we went out the window with him. And I hadn't really done any networking out here. And so I go to Guitar Center, which is where I bought my Marshall when I got out here, and asked the guy if he knew anyone was looking for a guitar player. He goes, "Oh, you should join Quiet Riot." I'm like, "Who?" "They're bigger than Van Halen." I go, "Well, that works for me." We literally call Rudy Sarzo up from the Guitar Center, who had just left the band to join Angel, but after him and I had talked, because he was from Florida.
Right. I had Rudy on here.
So he gives me Kevin's number. I call Kevin up. I bring Kevin an acetate of the record I just recorded with Alfonso. I mean, that's how old
this
is. Wow,
that's, yeah.
Yeah. I play him the acetate. And boom, I replaced Randy Rhoads. This is what I mean about the Forrest Gump stuff.
Yeah.
This was not by design. And at that time, Randy was, you know, the world didn't even know who he was. He was just off recording those records. I mean, you know, so, and then you kind of fast forward a little bit further from there. You know, I mean, I left that situation to play with Glenn Hughes, which you would have thought was a step in the right direction, but not at that moment in time. It turned out not to be. But then I end up replacing Yngwie Malmsteen in Steeler, because a friend of mine's a drummer in that band. You know, and again, it's being in all these situations to replace these guys who go on to become legendary is kind of...
Yeah, it's got to be. Okay, so let me ask you this. This is an unfair question, so you do not have to answer it, and I'll be happy to edit it out. you're like such a talented guy and you had all these situations, in your opinion, and I hate to say, I don't subscribe to the theory of this should have happened or that should have happened, because what happens happens, and there's no crystal ball. But as these things were going on, did it, like, what were you thinking? Because you were like so close to the quote proverbial brass ring. I mean, like,
yeah, okay. I think I did myself a little bit of a disservice by always adhering to somebody else's project. You right. know, yeah. I wish I had found the singer I was looking for and done my own band and run it the way I wanted to run it. You know, because I could come up with
fair enough reasons
why things weren't working, you know, and I mean, I did. I had a very good band with Ralph Saines, you know, the singer from Steel Panther. Him, myself, Sean McNabb, and Paul Monroe from XYZ had a band called 7% Solution. I mean, it should have been huge, but we put it together in 93. Guess what?
Yeah, grunge.
Nobody cared.
Yeah, yeah. And I hear that so consistently from 80s, 90s, you know, whatever the era is. Yeah, there's always a...
I mean, but this is the thing. I didn't have that at the right time.
Yeah.
And so that's why it didn't happen then. And at the time, I can look back and go, yeah, I was always kind of... I was... You know, it looked like a great decision to go from Talus to Heaven, because Heaven was signed to CBS and managed by Lieber and Krebs. And Talus was basically a vehicle for Billy Sheehan.
Right.
It seems like a no-brainer, but then you get into Heaven and you realize that the band had all sorts of problems from their prior records that I inherited. You know, I'm not talking about financial burdens, but, you know, people's agendas and things that, you know, have nothing to do with the music we're making. And I only find this stuff out years later, but, you know, the situation was doomed before we ever, you know.
Yeah, I totally get it. It's
left port.
I only ask that because I've asked that about myself at a lot of points in time in my life, because I've always been one of these guys, and I don't, as I've gotten older, I've realized that's a stupid thing to think. And I actually put up an article I read about this the other day on Everyone Loves Guitar Facebook. It was about this feeling that you should be here and you're not fill in the blank enough, you know, thin enough, successful enough, rich enough, strong, whatever the blank is for you at any given point in time. And I've come to the conclusion that for me anyway, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. But I have gone through a lot of that over my head. Why, you know, the why.
I get what you're saying. Let me tell you, I will tell you something, and this isn't to shamelessly promote the new record, but one thing I can tell you about doing that new record is I feel like, because I wrote everything on it and I produced it, and, you know, I arranged it, and I basically...
It's your baby, man. You birthed
it. My baby.
Yeah.
But it says everything about my music. I feel like just having it come out the way that it's come out, I've kind of attained something that I hadn't felt I had.
That's awesome. This is
just on a musical level.
Yeah.
And that to me, I mean, that's a huge payoff. When you can, when look, we know what the music business is like, and it's not what it was.
Yeah.
But when you can still do something and be as excited about it as I am now, that's a gift in itself.
100%. Yeah.
100%. You know, and like I said, I'm glad now that this is here, because I can take it and show it to anyone and go, here, yeah, this is what I do. And I feel that strong about it.
That's great. Yeah. So, I'm excited to hear it. I'm happy that, I think when you do something like that, it gives you, freedom, sort of. It puts any weight that you have had on your shoulders, and it takes them off, man. It's like, you're
spot on the money there, because it did exactly that. Yeah. And I didn't even expect that. You know, I wasn't looking for that when we were recording, but it's been a nice little bonus since we've been finishing up.
That's awesome, man. Tell me, who's had the biggest influence on you musically and also personally?
Oh, musically, Pat Thrall, Edgar Winter, Gary Moore. Todd Rundgren. Prince. Yeah, I mean, you know, you listen, when I say Prince, you go, I don't hear any Prince in your music. And this is true.
No, but I'm assuming you're talking about from a writing and creativity standpoint.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. What I love about Prince is the way he looks at a song. I mean, he makes songs. He could rip with anybody, but he creates songs.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great arranger.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he understands every note of everything that everybody's doing at every minute. You know, he was magic. You know, it's still to this day one of the best shows I ever saw. Do you remember there's a place called Flippers? It was a roller skating rink in L.A. It was where, like, Cher and everybody would go to roller skate on Tuesday nights.
That's funny. And you saw Prince there at Flippers.
Prince played that roller skating rink in 1980. And, I mean, it was the R&B band, not the pop band.
Right.
It was, you know, and they didn't get better than that.
Yeah.
I'm goosebumps thinking about how good that was.
That's cool. You know, it's funny about Cher. She always hires guitar players that have the same look. Like, I had Joel Hoekstra on the show. Oh my God. You guys could be brothers, man.
You know, the first time we met, it was the first thing we talked about is some video that somebody had put up of Joel playing at NAMM, and they called him me.
It's so funny, man. All her guitar players are like very rock looking. You guys all have the look, man. It's really, really funny.
Joel's monster. I love his guitar player.
Yeah, really good guitar player, man. He's a New York cat.
Yeah. No, we had fun. We were on one of those Monsters of Rock cruises, and he was doing this thing in acoustic. He called it, you know, Joel's, you know, acoustic hangover. And he'd go do an acoustic set for an hour.
That's nice.
And so he says, hey, you want to come up and play the second half of it with me? I go, yeah. And so we'll figure out what we're going to do. So I get up there. He goes, so you want to do songs or should we just go for it? Me, you don't have to ask twice. Let's just go for it.
Right. I figured you'd
and,
say that.
And, man, we went for a half an hour. I wish I could find a tape of what we did.
Nice.
It was a blast.
Nice. He's pretty serious about his playing, as you are.
Oh,
you
know? He's brilliant.
Really, he's professional.
Of all the new guys, you know, I mean, he's as good a guitar player as anyone out there.
Two questions left, man, and thank you for all your time. Tell me about a specific experience that changed your life or changed the way you think about things.
in a lifetime filled with this experiences.
There's a lot of those.
Yeah, man.
I can tell you, there's a day I quit drinking.
Good for you. How long you been sober, man?
I stopped in 2004, May of 2004.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, I got lucky. I mean, one thing I always said is I would never, I knew enough about driving to not drink and drive. Long story short, I got out of, I got very lucky in a situation coming home from a party.
Wow.
I managed to spin a car at 80 miles an hour on an on-ramp and hit nothing and not be hit. So I'd say that would be your moment of clarity.
There. Yeah, man, that's a moment of clarity. Holy shit. Yeah, because, you know, the universe has a way of whispering in your ear.
Yeah, I looked up and said, okay, I hear you.
Right. Because if you don't listen, each successive, hit over the head is louder, man, you know? Yeah. Congratulations. That's awesome, man. Really, really cool. And last question, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of that has been intentional and how much is a natural part of aging?
Well, I've just become a way nicer person because I have two wonderful women in my life.
Right on, man.
Hi, Ruth. Hi, Fee.
Right on. That's cool. Hey, listen, first of all, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for everything. I appreciate
it. Thank you. It's been a blast talking to you.
Thank you, man. Likewise. And let me just remind people what you got going on. It's Mitch Perry. Check out Mitch's website at mitchperry.com. It's Perry. Also, he's on tour with The Sweet. So when you see them coming to town, come see Mitch. And every Sunday, if you're in LA or Hermosa Beach area, he plays at Hermosa Beach at The Standing Room. And we will all look forward to Music Box, the Mitch Perry Group new record coming out in the next few months. And hopefully Mitch will come back on the show. We'll promote it and talk about it. Anything else I missed, man?
Nah, pretty thorough there.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. And check out Mitch's guitars. God, you're a great player, but when you that guitar is just the coolest guitar I've ever seen, man. Oh, it's just like so authentic, you know. It's really cool, and like I said, it's really nice to watch you play because you could see the joy you have in playing, man. It's just really that comes across loud, and that's not something you could fake, you know. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that.
Oh, you're welcome. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Check out Mitch Perry again on tour with Sweet in Hermosa Beach at The Standing Room, and we'll wait for the Mitch Perry Group record Music Box in the next few months. Thanks to Mitch for spending time with us. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. Thank you so much, Mitch. I appreciate it, bro.
I got
you. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.